CB, University of Texas at Austin versus SO. Whenever you're ready, sir.
May it please the court, Michael Abrams for State Appellants. This case involves credible evidence that SO altered and misrepresented key data in her dissertation. UT Austin has the authority to investigate this situation and determine, after an internal academic disciplinary proceeding consistent with its rules, what the proper sanction, if any, should be. SO has stymied that proceeding from moving forward for years, and there is no basis for her continued efforts to keep those proceedings from happening. Thus, UT Austin should prevail on appeal for two reasons. First, on remand from this court's 2017 opinion, the only live issue before the trial court was whether UT Austin has authority to conduct an academic disciplinary proceeding, regardless of its outcome. But the trial court did not address that question. Instead, the trial court reached a separate, unripe question, whether UT Austin has the express or implied authority to revoke SO's degree. Because the trial court should not have reached that issue, as it is hypothetical, contingent, and remote, this court should reverse the trial court's final judgment. Second, if the court does reach the revocation question, the court should conclude, like all other courts to have addressed the issue, and consistent with the broad delegation of authority in the Texas Education Code, that UT Austin has the authority to revoke a degree so long as due process is provided. I'd like to turn first to ripeness. The district court granted SO's motion for summary judgment and held that UT Austin does not have the express or implied authority to revoke SO's degree. But that issue is hypothetical, contingent, and remote, and thus unripe for two reasons. First, this court has already recognized that the revocation of SO's degree is not ripe because it has not happened. In footnote 4 of the court's 2017 opinion, the court noted that to the extent SO's pleadings complain of or seek a declaration regarding the actual revocation of her degree, an event that has not occurred, the claim is not ripe. Thus, the law of the case is that because the revocation has not occurred, SO cannot seek a declaration regarding the potential revocation of her decree.
Counsel, wasn't the issue this court remanded to the trial court whether the university acted extra vires with regard to the UDJA issue?
Your Honor, the issue was the nature of the controversy was whether the act of conducting a disciplinary proceeding to consider revoking the degree was ultra vires regardless of the outcome. And so our focus is on those words, regardless of the outcome, because to reach the issue of whether UT Austin has the authority to actually revoke the degree, you would have to assume that the results of the future disciplinary proceeding is that the hearing officer would conclude that revocation is the appropriate sanction, and that the president would then uphold that sanction if SO were to appeal it.
Weren't there other options given to UT? Or was revocation the only possibility?
Revocation is not the only possibility. Okay. So under UT Austin's internal disciplinary proceedings and policies, there were several options that are on the table, including a broad provision that said a sanction that is appropriate under the circumstances. And so it's not a certainty that SO's degree would be revoked after this hearing. There are other possible sanctions.
So is it possible that language that says insofar as could have been referring to that there could still be some actions that were specifically enumerated and allowed that could have occurred, therefore not going to go farther?
Right. There could have been the results of the academic disciplinary proceeding is still open. Mm-hmm. And so revocation is certainly one potential option. And what the trial court has essentially done is the trial court has not ruled and said we don't have the authority or UT Austin does not have the authority to actually revoke the degree. What the trial court That is what the trial court has said. But what the trial court hasn't said is that we don't have the authority to conduct a disciplinary proceeding. So theoretically, what could happen now if we move forward is that UT Austin could have its disciplinary proceeding and all options are on the table except for revocation. And so that kind of puts the cart before the horse, and that we've reached what the sanction would be before we even had the hearing. And I think that demonstrates why this matter is not, why the question of revocation specifically is not right. Now, the question of whether we have the authority to conduct the disciplinary proceeding at all is what the 2017 opinion said is right. And that's what the trial court did not reach.
But even
The statutory authority for the university revoking a degree that it's awarded, duly awarded?
Your Honor, I would point the court to Texas Education Code, Section 6531. And so,
can you go to the specific language in the statute?
Yes, Your Honor. So I would point the court to the Texas Education Code's broad delegation of authority to the Board of Regents to promulgate rules and regulations for the effective management of UT. Now, the regents have then promulgated rules which require each UT institution to adopt rules and regulations concerning student conduct and discipline. And the regents' rules have the force and effect of law. Now, UT Austin's institutional rules specifically provide that one possible outcome of a disciplinary hearing where academic misconduct is involved is revocation of the degree. And the regents have approved of UT Austin's institutional rules. And that's what makes it very different from the 1969 Attorney General opinion that SO references in her brief. That broad delegation of authority, and especially the UT Austin institutional rules that specifically provide for revocation, is not mentioned anywhere in that opinion. So that's where I would point the court to UT Austin's authority by statute to revoke the degree. And that doesn't even speak to what other courts have recognized as a university's implied authority to revoke a degree, because part and parcel of being able to award a degree is being able to revoke it so long as due process is provided.
So in that, you're talking about the authority cited from other states?
That's correct, Your Honor. This issue hasn't been reached in the Texas courts. But at the time of the 1969...
So this would be the first court to declare that there is an implied authority to revoke, even in the absence of any express statutory basis to do so.
This would be the first court to reach the issue of authority to revoke a degree in the state of Texas.
Okay.
That issue has just not come up, and it hadn't come up at the time of the 1969 Attorney General opinion.
Right. And so why should we treat this different from any other license or permit, that usually when the legislature is creating, this kind of a scheme, they say, hey, you can give a license, and then you also have to provide some rules and procedures for how to take that license away. Why should this be treated differently than that?
So I think what those other courts have recognized is that there's something unique about conferring a degree. It's an ongoing certification.
The ones from out of state?
Yes, the other courts from out of state.
Okay.
Have recognized that it's a certification to the world at large of the recipient's educational achievement. And so what the problem would be is to hold that a university could never withdraw a degree would essentially be requiring a university to continue making a false certification to the public at large of the accomplishment of that person.
So go ahead.
What's to prevent the university from withdrawing degrees posthumously or after many, many years a person has had a degree?
Sure. I think what our position is not that a degree can just be revoked at the snap of a finger. That is not our position. Consistent with the positions of other courts who have reached this issue, our position is that it can only be revoked after due process is provided. And so here, the intent is to provide notice and an opportunity to be heard, the opportunity to present witnesses, the opportunity to present evidence for SO to speak on her own behalf, and then after all the evidence is heard, to reach a decision on what the appropriate sanction should be.
And again, the basis for doing so is based upon the welfare of the students, or is that, what part is of that authority are we talking about? Where does that come from?
I think it is in part based on the welfare of the students and also other individuals who have received the degree and who count on the value of that degree moving forward for them.
Okay, well, let's do this hypothetical. I mean, Do you think, like, let's say, the University of Michigan is still a reputable school, because I got to use something that's not from Texas. So is University of Michigan still a good university?
Yes, I'm an Ohio State fan, but yes.
I had no idea. Boy, that's perfect, isn't it? Yeah, okay. So, okay, assume that University of Michigan, if you're not from Ohio State.
Right.
What about the fact that the Unabomber is from there? Is the University of Michigan, is their prestige affected by the fact that he holds a doctoral degree in mathematics?
Right, and I think the bigger, and I understand the court, Your Honor's point, but I think the bigger picture is that the academic integrity of the entire institution is weakened if the university has to, for not just for one case, but in general, does not have the authority to maintain the integrity of its degree. So there could be isolated situations, and I think we all understand that, but the idea that if you know,
or
there
like
has been fraud.
Presidents who have been disbarred, should they be able to keep their law degree?
Right, and I think that we should be able to, you know,
which is better, having a president or having somebody who's been disbarred? Which do we care about more?
Well, I think what the university cares about is preventing, is not being able to revoke a degree if there is evidence of fraud. And so that's where it's an ongoing relationship.
Okay.
Why would the university not have other remedies at its disposal other than remedies that the legislature didn't set forth in this statute?
Well, I think that academic institutions have broad authority generally to manage their own affairs. And so if I could give an example, courts do not require universities to sue a professor if they are revoking his tenure, which is every bit of property right as the property right of a degree. And so, you know, universities have that authority to manage their own affairs. And this is fundamentally an academic question, which is why the university has the authority to manage it. And I see I'm out of time for this round. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm here along with my co-counsel, David Sergi, on behalf of the appellee and cross-appellant SO, Dr. Orr. She has allowed me today to use her name in this courtroom.
Well, it was used initially, and I'm not really sure that there was a basis for withholding her name in the first instance, but that's okay. I mean,
I understand. But she is a person, a private individual citizen with constitutionally protected rights. She has a property right and a liberty right in her degree, and the university ignores that. We are here asking the court for three things. I'm going to discuss two of those three things. First, we ask the court to affirm the trial court's judgment that declares the university lacks the power to administratively revoke a degree. This requires the court to overrule the university's issues 1 and 2. And our second issue, I'll speak about our cross appeal. And in that issue, we ask the court to reverse the trial court's denial of attorney's fees, which were based on the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act, Section 37.009. To do this, the court would have to determine as a matter of law that the trial court erred in its conclusion that it was equitable and just to deny fees to Dr. Orr. This would ask the court to sustain our first issue on appeal and cross appeal. Turning to the first issue, this case does present an issue of first impression, as you acknowledged, Justice Goodwin. And it is going to ask, the court will have to decide whether a public university has the authority to administratively revoke a degree. That is, does the University of Texas have the power over a private citizen like Dr. Orr to conduct an administrative hearing years after she's graduated? And to accuse her of misconduct and to attempt to divest her of her constitutional rights? The answer is an unmistakable and unequivocal no. Now, I recognize the court has set another case for hearing today, being the KE case against Texas State University. And I would say that if we were watching a movie, that the case of SO is the prequel and the KE case is the sequel, because KE was actually forced to go through the disciplinary hearing and she was stripped of her PhD. Appellant's counsel noted, Dr. Orr has not yet been through a hearing, and this court held she should not until the trial court decided the issue of authority. Now, their first issue, they claim this court's 2017 decision limited the scope of remand. They're wrong, and this is why they're wrong. This court has already held that Dr. Orr has alleged a justiciable claim under the Declaratory Judgment Act for ultra-various conduct. It remanded to the trial court to determine the scope of UT's authority. And I don't think this court made a distinction between having a hearing and the revocation issue, because it's a distinction without a difference. Now, they want to say there are other potential sanctions besides revocation, but that's just a pretense. They've already revoked her degree once without a hearing and then reinstated it when she sued them and challenged them on it. And so that's really their goal. And if you look at the list...
Well, and let me ask you this. To what extent can we go back and look at all of what happened before? Should we pull out the briefing? Should we pull out all of the records? And should we get back into the weeds of what happened in the earlier cases? Or are we limited on this record?
I think that... the law of the case is the law of the case. So how far back do we want to go? Mm-hmm. The issues that are in front of this court are related to the 2017 appeal, the way they frame their issues on appeal. And if you look at the language...
But there was one before that, yes?
There's two 2017 opinions, and I'm glad you pointed that out. Because we read the first one, which was an injunction. It's a rare thing to get rid of an injunction out of a court of appeals. And the court said in this injunction, and I quote... you enjoined UT from conducting any proceeding for the purpose of deciding whether to revoke or otherwise take action towards SO's PhD with regard to her degree. As far as we're concerned, that language is broad, and it means you can't have a hearing until we know whether the school has statutory authority to do revocation. Now, the court's 2017 also said you need to decide the statutory authority. So this first issue is really something I think is a desperate attempt to stop the ruling that we got.
How do you get past footnote 4 in the 2017 opinion?
Because we're alleging an ultra vires claim. We're saying that under the enabling statutes of the Texas Education Code, the university has no authority to revoke a degree. So the court has already said she's alleged a justiciable claim, and they've already argued she hasn't been injured. She has to go through a hearing. And that was what we decided, or you decided in June of 2017. Yes, she does have a claim. Going through that hearing would be futile if they have no authority to revoke. And this court relied on the Strayhorn opinion for that, and correctly so. Now, if we want to look at the second issue, that's where the rubber meets the road on this ultra vires claim. The court will finally have to decide and interpret Section 65.31. And in 1969, we've all talked about the Attorney General opinion, which is a decision that's somewhat of a roadmap of the analysis we must use here. And they rightly said, when they interpreted the statute in 1969, that the university did not have the express authority or implied authority to revoke a degree, but they could do it in a court of competent jurisdiction. And that's what we have been saying.
So what would that look like then? What is a university's recourse if they find that a degree was secured by fraud or something along those lines?
Yes. So we're talking about a private citizen who's got vested constitutional rights. They would bring her a claim against her in court. If they feel like they have the evidence of misconduct, the nature of their relationship is contractual. And I could think of any number of claims, but I don't feel like I need to tell opposing counsel what causes of action to bring. They should figure that out on their own. But what they would do internally, and I think this is discussed as well in the AG opinion, is that if the university faculty determine that there was some misconduct and they want to bring a claim to revoke a degree, they go to the board and they get permission from the board, and the board brings the suit, period. And that's not difficult, and that can be done. Now, the university is insisting that they have this implied authority, this broad implied authority from another section of the statute, which gives them the power to make rules. But the power to make rules is limited to the power of rules to control, manage, and administer the system. Revocation has nothing to do with the management of the school or the operation of the school or any other administration. And if you accept their interpretation...
Well, what about, like, the language that says such acts to contribute to the development of universities or the system welfare? What about bigger, broader language like that?
If we start taking this really overly broad interpretation, Your Honor, of implied authority, you're going to end up swallowing the exception to the rule for ultra vires claims. There will be no rule they can ever make that
I can think of a hypothetical of how to do it. I mean, so, you know, there were a number of different cases from different states out there that were cited, and I'm not suggesting that this is where we go, but I mean, I think the argument could be made that you could do like Kent State and the Pittsburgh case that where they revoked degrees erroneously granted or they that were improperly conferred and therefore were void ab initio. Those, I think, could be separated from like Salisbury, UVA, the others where, you know, there's just good cause and after due process. I mean, those are kind of loosey-goosey. But at least if you had that cutting, you know, that stopping point of improperly conferred, you know, based on fraud or things like that, couldn't we devise something along those lines?
They can come sue in court for fraud. They can accuse her of fraud. I mean, this is a private citizen who's got her own personal interest at stake. The university's claim of an interest needs to give way to her interests. Her property interest and her liberty interest are greater than theirs at this point in time. For example, she is years into her career. She has patents, publications, all associated with her name. And
well,
so,
this has been going on for a long time. I mean, did the university wait years before they started to institute this action?
Yes, they did. She graduated in 2008, and they started in 2012.
Okay.
Yes. So the reason why, there are other reasons why the court, when you're interpreting the education code, should find no authority, is because we would be giving them the power to act as an administrative state agency, and that's expressly not allowed by the Administrative Procedure Act. And if you did, then that means, you know, a state agency under the APA, they have to have notice to the public and a chance to comment. And if you allow them to act as a state agency here, you're effectively not giving citizens the opportunity to debate these rules. Now, I would ask the court, you mentioned licenses and things like that. Well, I would ask you to look at the charter school case, Honors Academy versus TEA, which came out of this court that the Texas Supreme Court affirmed last year. And that case is a perfect example that demonstrates the legislature, again, did not intend to give the university any authority to revoke and divest a citizen of a property or liberty interest. The charter schools have a statute in the education code, which is, I believe, 12.115. And under that statute, the Commissioner of Education has mandatory revocation powers when certain conditions are met. The charter schools argued that they had vested property rights to be a charter school. The Texas Supreme Court said, no, you have merely a license. You are not a private citizen, and you don't get those constitutional rights. So what this tells us, the legislature knows that you use when to use express authorities, power to award something, and when to revoke something, especially with respect to property and liberty rights. If they wanted, they know you can't deprive a private citizen of their property and liberty rights administratively, period. You do it in a court of law. Bottom line is, you would be giving them, again, the broad rulemaking authority, and there's never a rule that they can't make. They can do whatever they want. It swallows the ultra vires exception. In terms of her liberty interests, I'd like to emphasize, it's not just the freedom to pursue her education or her career or her profession or to write papers. It's also freedom from governmental intrusion. She's also entitled to protect her good name and her reputation. This whole experience over 7 years, going on eight, it prevents her from being able to pursue other educational and professional opportunities, including publications, just like lawyers like to publish and other scientists publish in journals. She's been precluded from doing those things by this. And so, again, I emphasize that UT's interest, their claimed interest to protect the integrity of their degree, must give way. They think that they just have to give due process. But the reality is there is no due process in this circumstance to a citizen, because really, that's what she is now. She's years later, she's a graduate, she's on in her life, And you can't have due process in the halls at UT. It's not an impartial tribunal. And constitutional due process requires a fair and impartial tribunal. It cannot be where the victim is the judge and the jury and the executioner, and that's precisely what's happened at UT. If you look in the record and you look at exhibits attached to the motion for summary judgment, you'll find that the people they appointed to be hearing officers all recused three different times in anticipation of the court's April 2017 injunction. Three different people said, we can't be impartial. We report to the complaining party, the complaining professor. So no, I'm not going to be the hearing officer. I can't do it. And that just underscores the point. The last thing I'll talk about briefly is the factors for our request for attorney's fees. There's four requirements under the Declaratory Judgment Act, and which is equitable in nature. And two of those requirements are questions of law, whether it's equitable and just to deny fees or award fees. The trial court's comments on the record show that it was reasonable and necessary, the hours, the time, and the effort spent on this case. And I would ask the court to look at the record of the March 2019 hearing for those comments. But in that hearing, the court also said, without explanation, she considered many factors in concluding it was equitable to deny our fees. Now, in my research preparing for the briefs, I could not find a single case that enumerated every factor that is considered in equity, what's fair, what's just. It's one of those I know it when I see it things.
And how does this court revisit the trial court's decision when it is discretionary? I mean, may award, equitable, just. How do we get there?
Because it's so manifestly unjust. It's a question of law that you can decide that it was arbitrary and capricious, not based on any relevant factors. We don't know what factors she considered, other than saying everybody had something to fight for. Well, isn't that true in every case? Everybody has something worth fighting for. The other factors that are in the case law that really weigh in favor of granting our fees request here is, one, the relief we received is far great, should have been given far greater weight than the weight that of the orders dismissing the constitutional claims of due process. Their claims were dismissed on jurisdiction, but we got the final summary judgment. And I will tell you that it was merely tying up loose ends. And if you'll allow me just a moment to go through a couple more factors. Yes. I would ask the court to consider that there's an imbalance and abuse of power by the government where the officials, by these officials. And so it weighs in her favor because she has no other remedy at law. And that's the point of these fee-shifting statutes, is to award fees so we don't incentivize bad behavior. We don't want to reward that. And that's what's been going on here, an egregious abuse of power that's attempting to railroad a person into a partial tribunal where the outcome is guaranteed. And for those reasons, I ask the court to find that the injustice is self-evident and award her her fees and to further affirm the trial court's judgment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Abrams, let me just start off with a question.
Sure.
How do you address SO's argument that it's not possible to get due process when that due process is happening within the halls of UT?
Sure, and that was exactly what I was going to start with, Your Honor. So actually, I think that the facts in the record show the extent to which UT is prepared to give her due process. So for example, one of the facts that she mentioned is that some of the hearing officers have been recused. That's because we've worked with her when she has, you know, raised these concerns. We've said, okay, well, we'll try to find someone else. So, you know, we are not trying to present her or have her come forward and go through a hearing that she does not believe is in front of an impartial hearing officer. So we're working with her on the hearing officer. And in fact, she also had the option of going before a student conduct board. She initially decided to do that and then chose to go with the hearing officer instead. And we, you know, assented to that as well. This issue of the alterations of data in her dissertation first came to light in 2011, 2012. And that's when we immediately started investigating it.
So why is the typical doctoral process insufficient to preserve the integrity of the award of the degree?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Isn't that what
the dissertation is supposed to be about? I mean, isn't the whole doctoral process designed to challenge and to examine the dissertation itself?
That's true, Your Honor, and sometimes something can slip through the cracks. I mean, someone can...
Why did this slip through for 6 years, though?
Well, there was there was an article that was published that used this data, and a graduate assistant uncovered that some of the data had been altered or misrepresented. And so that's how this particular episode came to light.
So then that would imply potentially, at least if everything you say is true, that could imply some like fraudulent conduct. Why is it that UT cannot come back at any point in time and say, hey, this degree was fraudulently obtained, and then seek their relief in an independent, before a neutral and detached magistrate, something us criminal law practitioners, we like that phrase a lot, but in a court of law?
I think it goes back to, this is an academic matter that should be resolved in the university setting. And to that point, it actually shows, SO's counsel just presented a sort of parade of horribles of what could happen if you allow UT Austin to revoke a degree. But you could also look at it in the other direction. There's nothing in the Texas Education Code that says the university has a right to expel a student. The university has a right to suspend a student for cheating. But those rules are created by the regents, in tune with the regents' rules that give us authority to discipline students. And that's all part of the management of the university. And so if you go to this point where the university doesn't have the authority to revoke a degree, you could piece that back and reach the point where the university doesn't have authority to expel a student, to suspend a student, without going through a proceeding in a courtroom. And so the courts have repeatedly recognized that universities are not courtrooms, and it's not desirable that they become courtrooms. And what SO is asserting is that the university has almost no authority to control its own affairs.
But you just said a student, and we're not talking about a student.
But it is an ongoing relationship. Even though the degree has been conferred, that doesn't mean that it's the end of the
relationship. You know, I don't hear from my university except for to ask for donations. I mean, I'm just saying. Right or wrong, that's kind of how it is. And what concerns me, it's kind of like some of the authority that you brought in from the other jurisdictions. You know, when you have like the Kent State and the Pittsburgh, where they're saying, oh, only for those things where the degrees were erroneously granted, or those that were obtained by fraud and improperly conferred. But if we start getting into, and if what you're suggesting is just we have the power to grant a degree there, ipso facto, we must have the power to take it away, then we start getting into those cases where they go, oh, well, you know, for good cause, and as long as they have, you know, process, that seems very arbitrary.
I don't think it's arbitrary because the individual is still entitled to process. I think that's the critical component. This is not just take away the degree without providing process. It is providing process. Now, it may not be the process that SO would prefer, but no court has ever said that you're
correct,
entitled to your absolute preferred process. So, for instance, in the academic disciplinary proceeding or Title IX context, it's not that you have the right to, you know, proceedings in a courtroom like you would, but you do have the right to process, understanding that it's in the university and academic context. But all of this goes to the first issue that we raised, which is, does the court even need to reach the issue of revocation? I'd actually argue that one of the strongest evidence in the record that revocation is not automatic is that the Scientific Investigative Committee, and this is in the live petition, investigated the allegations, and by a 2-to-1 vote found academic misconduct. And one of the votes was that there was something irregular, but that it didn't rise to the level of misconduct. And that was someone within the university investigating that. And so what's to say that the hearing officer wouldn't come to the same conclusion? I mean, what's to say that the hearing officer wouldn't reach the same conclusion as the member of that investigative committee who said, okay, there's something off here, but it doesn't rise to the level of academic misconduct? It is speculative that the hearing officer will conclude that she committed academic misconduct and that as a result of that misconduct, the sanction should be revocation. And so that's why it's premature to reach the issue, because as the framework for rightness indicates, it can't be something that's contingent or hypothetical or remote, and this is all three of those things. I'd also like to briefly turn to the question of attorney's fees. As the court noted, that is a discretionary function, and the court noted that both sides prevail to significant degrees, and I think that that's true here. As we explained earlier, the university, under the trial court's ruling, still has the right to conduct an academic disciplinary proceeding, and only one option is off the table. And so I think that the trial court acted within its discretion to deny Esso's counsel's attorney's fees request. Finally, there was one other issue on the cross appeal that I wanted to briefly mention, which is that Esso seeks to have the court render a judgment that the 2003 university catalog in effect when Esso was a graduate student constitutes a binding contract with the university, and that the university cannot enforce any rules enacted after she was a student. There are multiple problems with these claims. First of all, the court has already held that a determination regarding the rules the university intends to apply is not yet ripe. Furthermore, there's no evidence in the record of what the difference would be between the 2003-2004 rules and the 2013-2014 rules. If anything, she has the greater access to potential remedies in that she could have a student conduct board or a hearing officer hear her disciplinary proceeding under the later rules, whereas in the earlier rules, she would only have a hearing officer. Second, to the extent her requested declarations seek to establish the validity of a binding contract, that claim is barred by immunity. The courts have frequently said that the only way to establish a breach of contract claim is through the legislature, and the legislature has not waived immunity for breach of contract claims. And so, for all of these reasons, UT Austin respectfully requests that this court reverse the trial court's judgment and render that the issue of whether UT Austin has authority to revoke a degree is not justiciable.
I think that's it.
I was entitled to 5 extra minutes as a cross
appellant. Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot. Thank you.
Wait a minute.
That's okay.
Thank you.
So I'd like to start with a case that I'm surprised nobody's mentioned yet, which is the University of Texas versus Thann. That was a case of first impression where a medical student was dismissed for cheating after he had a hearing. The Texas Supreme Court ultimately concluded that Mr. Thann was denied due process because there was a fatal defect in the hearing procedure. And they reversed and allowed him a new hearing. But that case is different for exactly the reason you said, Justice Baker, which is that was a current student, not a graduate and private citizen years later. So this case is the next saga, which is years later, can you come back and do this? And the court was focused on the enabling statutes. And UT has yet to tell us why they can act like a state agency or have these administrative powers where effectively there will be never any review of it. When we talk about implied authority, there's an important point that I think is being lost, which is that implied authority is very limited, and it's got to be limited to what is reasonably necessary to give effect to the express powers. The express power here is to award a degree. You do not need the power to revoke a degree to be able to award it, okay? We're talking about constitutional rights at this point once you've walked out the door and you start paying your student loans. And Justice Goodwin is right. You don't hear from them again until it's, you know, alumni time to solicit donations. Now, why did this slip through the crack for 6 years? Opposing counsel says this is based on an article from 2011, and that is so fundamentally wrong. They cannot come after her for conduct that happened after she graduated. And once we objected and pointed that out to them, they decided to find 3 data points out of literally thousands of data points that are open to subjective interpretation to say you misinterpreted that data. So let's take that and apply it to us as lawyers. I think we have at least one UT law grad on this panel. If you're a UT law grad and say you were in the law review or hell, we all took, you know, research and writing. What if they come back and said, you misinterpreted a case. You misinterpreted a statute. We're coming after you for your degree. What's to stop them from doing that? Nothing. And that's why giving them implied authority leads to absurd results and results you just can't allow. Now, they've argued that this is an academic matter. I ask you again to look at the Thane case. It actually will explain to you, and it has a quote that says, it is not an academic matter at this point, not when you're dealing with a decision like this. It's disciplinary. And so she gets different kinds of due process. Thane sets procedural and substantive due process, and when you consider the factors in Thane, again, her competing interests have to give way to theirs.
But unlike Thane, Thane was dismissed and then brought suit, where we haven't reached that point yet, right? Because her degree is not yet, has not been revoked, and the state is representing that it might not even be revoked.
Correct.
So how applicable is that case to our scenario?
It's applicable for the discussion on due process and the fact that it reaffirms a person has a property and liberty interest in their degree. It actually only acknowledges the liberty interest to protect your good name, your reputation, to pursue your professional opportunities. And it's the U.S. Supreme Court and other federal precedent that, and later Texas precedent, that acknowledges you have a property right in your degree. Now, he went through a hearing because he was a current student when he was dismissed. This is a different situation. This is somebody who's back in the real world working and trying to establish her career and do the profession she chose. She's being accused of misconduct. She's got to protect her good name, and she needs to be able to do what she studied to do, which she spent years doing. And you're correct. There was a dissertation process, a committee of five. And one of those committee members, Professor Magnus, actually did not participate. He testified before the trial court, and he's got an affidavit in our record that says this was a predetermined outcome. He asked to see some of the data that they were concerned about, and they wouldn't give it to him. He was shut out of the process. He knew, and he was convinced, that this was predetermined. He's a professor emeritus who was there for like 50 years, and he's finally retired. And he said he'd never seen degree revocation. It's a rare and harsh remedy. It's not a trivial matter.
I would like to address your cross petition. And thanks for reminding me that that's why we're up here again, because I almost left that out. Could you address the assertion that that the contractual claim, that your attempt to say that there is a valid contract, that claim is not subject to sovereign immunity?
100%. Thank you for asking me that, because I have a note here and I was going to forget if you didn't. We're not asking to assert a contract claim. And from what we read in their briefs and what you see from what counsel has said, UT's trying to employ some ad hoc process to keep changing the rules as they go. Back in 2015, when I was first hired and brought on the case along with Mr. Sergi, they decided, okay, well, we're going to apply the rules of 2013 or 2014. There were actually multiple versions that went back and forth, and we said, which one is it? And they said, it's 2014. And we said, how can you do that? She graduated in 03. Texas case law is very well established in a case, again, involving UT, the University of Texas versus Babb. The relationship between them is contractual, and we are merely asking for a declaration that says this is the contract and these are the rules that should be applied to her. And precedent after Babb and including Babb say you cannot apply rules to this person that were modified, amended, or changed after their enrollment. It's got to be the rules that applied when they were enrolled. And that's what we're asking the court to declare.
And all of that is already within the original record down below. We don't need anything new to establish these things.
It's in the record of this case that was filed in 2015 or 2016. Okay. It's all in this record, yes.
There are no new additional facts that are going to need to be considered in that regard.
Not at all. And so if I can just go one more to answer that. In the 2017 opinion, the court said that those issues were not yet ripe.
Correct.
That is, I partially disagree with that statement.
So we were kind of right, but we weren't completely right.
There's some issues that, if you want to talk about factual development, you see them in the KE case.
Okay.
Because you go through the hearing and you see what really happened that makes it so fundamentally flawed. But here we can also look at things as a question of law. on the due process issues, which is it's not an impartial tribunal, and which rules apply. We need to be able to know those things.
And so have you, are there any additional facts in this case that would cause us to have to revisit that prior, I mean, that we can go outside that prior determination that it wasn't right?
To change that decision? I think yes, because we also have shown the court the sham investigation that she was excluded from the dissertation committee. She was not allowed to speak to them and present to them evidence, which is exactly one of the reasons why Than was determined he didn't have due process. He was excluded from part of the investigation and the hearing. So Dr. Orr was not allowed to explain herself in answer to these questions about these data points. There's a very significant affidavit as well in that record, which is undisputed, and UT has never wanted to talk about it, from one of the students who reproduced her research following her. His initials were JT. He continued her research, and he reproduced the same results as her. And he signed an affidavit saying that, and he also signed an affidavit that says the alleged alterations on those papers were my handwriting. So, yes, you have solid grounds, Your Honor, to look at the due process issues and decide this is so fundamentally wrong that if they want to revoke her degree, come to the courthouse and do it. Thank you.
Thank you.